This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 19th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Coming up today, as Monocle's biggest ever edition hits the shelves, I chat with creative director Rich Spencer Powell and photo director Poppy Shibamoto about the challenges of creating a 408-page colossus.
We have photographers all around the world, so I mean, in a busy week, we'll be sending photographers to shoot like perhaps like 50 shoots in a day or something crazy. But yeah, it's all manageable.
We meet the brains behind the thrilling design of the new Terminal 2 at Incheon Airport in Seoul, which recently broke ground.
The notion is you bring the commerce to the airport, it serves a need in the community, it reduces traffic congestion on the roads, which has environmental benefits, it brings needed revenue to the airport.
And then we head to Lisbon to see how a set of product designers, industrial designers, and Pritzker Prize winning architects are taking a fresh look at one of Portugal's most important natural resources.
Take a look at this fantastic material, it's a sustainable material, and do think about situations, ideas, dreams, I don't know, objects, structures, to apply it according to this way of living of the 21st century.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Now, for the magazine subscribers listening among you, we suggest you give your letterbox a word of warning. The biggest ever issue of Monocle is about to pass through its openings. The December-January issue is our annual forecast of the year ahead, and it's a stonking 408-page tome that also includes the Travel Top 50 special and the Monocle 100 supplement. Once we've caught our breath after production, Monocle's art desk King and Queen, creative director Rich Spencer Powell and photo director Poppy Shibamoto join me in the studio. I ask them about the design challenges of pulling off such a colossal creation.
It's the second biggest issue of the year, and you think about the rhythm of all 10 issues in the year. And there are some slimmer issues and there are some heavier issues. And this is the one that takes you even longer to read. It's denser. You might digest it over a slightly longer period. And you just have to bear that in mind, and you can't make it breathe as much as you can of a normal issue. But it's a different, slightly different nature of magazine this time out, as with the July, August, summer issue. So you try things like you use all your sort of design skills and colour and navigation, and you work very hard on the pace, and we change stock so that there are kind of visual sort of notices that you're in different sections, particularly with the supplements. We made one of the supplements detachable to kind of bring the size down so that you're not having all 400 pages at once. But overall, it's just a kind of group effort, really, I think, in terms of flat plan, pacing, materials, and then design.
Mm. I mean, just talking of content, we do have the big interviews at the beginning of the magazine, which is something that is a sort of one-off for this issue, isn't it? And just the way we approach them, it's, over a whole spread and just the...
Yeah, we let it breathe a little bit. The other thing to remember is it is a 400-page issue, but there's a lot of advertising in there as well. So, for the reader's eye, it does need some little changes of pace. So there we have full bleed images and a full single of text. So it's quite a lot to take in, but it's done a little bit easier, I think. So it's although there's a lot to read, it's not so dense. It's quite simple, that layout. And that runs over sort of 10 pages. So it starts off quite light in a way.
And could you just sort of give our listener a little summary of what they can expect? I mean, how many paper stocks, how many different typefaces are in it compared to a standard issue of Monocle?
It's one or two extra typefaces to kind of pan out the supplements. But it's our usual collection of supplements. It's a classic issue. They can expect a couple of numeral listings of travel and one of for 100, which is about the best things in the world. There is a very nice fashion story in there, big black and white that runs over 15, 16 pages, which is nice.
And the black and white's a bit of a...
Yeah, it's something that I think we probably could do more of. But again, it's a kind of a classic type of fashion shoot, and we just thought the black and white suited it. But again, when you're dealing with 400 pages, that of course as well, when you get from colour into black and white, that changes the pace again. It gives you another little break. But that's a very nice story. And an expo is very nice as well. Yeah, basically expect a lot, I would say.
And Poppy, coming over to you, I mean, I don't think we've got any idea how many pictures are in this issue overall.
Don't ask me, I haven't finished counting or how many photographers contributed to this issue. I mean, we have a listing of 50 and 100 things, Travelot 50 and 100. So obviously it's going to be more than 150 people contributing to this issue.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Just from a sort of process point of view, how on earth do you go about organising that? I mean, I know you're sort of slightly enslaved to us editors to wait until we give you the ideas, but what's your process?
I mean, it was quite good that this month we got a little bit ahead with Travelot 50 because that's accumulation of a whole year of travelling by editors and Tyler. So that's been started quite early on in the month and we shot some things in the summer, so that was great. But we have photographers all around the world, so I mean some weeks that in a busy week we'll be sending photographer to shoots, like perhaps like 50 shoots in a day or something crazy. But yeah, it's all manageable.
Can you give me a few ideas of some of your favourite stories from a photo point of view?
Okay, so three stories. The X was great. Not two, actually. I changed my mind. X was really good. It was really planned before, got visa access, everything. So got travel insurance. Everything was kind of planned really well. So it looks great. And I think also it was a surprise to see something that not many people had seen.
That was in Kashgar, wasn't
Kashgar,
it?
Kashgar, yeah. And also I think it goes back to sort of first year of Monaco where we discover a place and show something that reader might not have seen.
Mm.
So that's really nice. It's a classic piece. Fashion was good because it was kind of different.
Can you just tell us a bit about the concept behind the fashion?
The concept is it's sort of like a kind of like New Year's resolutions manifesto for the year ahead. So it's quite old-fashioned in how it looks, I suppose, and it's things like play a board game rather than playing on your phone and an app, and it's review your wardrobe, and it's, you know, instead of planning a holiday where you go back to your favourite villa or your favourite island, it's about planning a road trip that it's good to roam around. And it's those sort of 15 simple concepts. And we've just sort of shot a fashion story which illustrates them. So it's all shot in studio. It's quite playful. Shot film, a nice one of our favourite photographers, and yeah, it's just quite sweet. It's a little
it's
breath of fresh
of
air.
It's kind of like a promotion of slow thinking or living, isn't it?
Yeah. And as we move into the new year, can we expect any new little rejigs in the way Monaco looks? Are we having a little refresh in the mag? Or
Possibly, yeah. I can't give away too much, but I have had a couple of emails in my inbox this week about planning for the year ahead, and it's something that we regularly do. We always say we like to evolve, not, you know, revolt, as it were. But yeah, we'll be looking to refresh things. We're looking at bringing in some new stories, and inevitably that means some new designs.
That was Monocle's very own Rich Spencer-Powell and Poppy Shibamoto joining me in the Midori House studios there. Next up, we're in Korea. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Often cited as one of the world's best transport hubs, ground recently broke in South Korea for Incheon International Airport's Terminal 2. In an attempt to outdo its older brother, the $2 billion expansion will consist of 72 gates, indoor gardens, and even koi ponds, to name just a few of the many amenities. Our correspondent in Seoul, Jason Strother, recently met the architect overseeing the entire project. He told Jason what goes into designing a modern, award-winning airport.
Airports aren't the utilitarian fly-in and fly-out conduits they used to be, or at least they shouldn't be, says Keith Thompson, the LA-based principal of the global design and architecture firm Gensler. He says there's a new trend in airport design that shifts focus from taking off to touching down. It's something he calls the upside-down terminal.
Thinking back historically, the terminals by and large have been designed around the departing experience. But the departing passenger has already been here. They know what the experience in the community is, and there's been a certain lack of attention paid to the arriving passenger. The arriving experience is we really want to communicate to the passenger, welcome to the city. Here's the experience. Here's the culture. We're proud of it. You know, here's what you can do. And a lot that gets lost in a lot of airports as you come in and you go down in a hole in the ground, and there's the baggage claim, and you push out to the curb.
Thompson, who's been involved in about 60 airport design projects, says you can enhance the passenger experience by creating an atmosphere where jet-setters can relax, dine, and of course, take advantage of the abundant retail space, which brings in income that airports need to cover operating costs.
That in turn has grown and developed to where airports essentially rival shopping malls in a lot of cases.
Based on the work that you've done at San Francisco's International Airport Terminal 2, JFK Terminal 5, do you see a direct correlation between design and a positive passenger experience as well as business success within the airport?
Unquestionably. And, you know, it really gets to a point that I think is an important part of the passenger experience, and that's being relaxed and calm, because travel by and large is a stressful experience. There are a couple of aspects of Terminal 2 at San Francisco that make that a more relaxed experience. One is the recomposition areas. When you go through security, normally you're faced with a series of partitions and a couple of benches, and people are bumping up against you. But in San Francisco T2, it's open to the concourse beyond. There's upholstered cushions that you can sit on to put your shoes back on, organize your family, and move on. That by itself takes a certain amount of stress off, because you can see the process beyond you. You're not jostled and bumped and crowded, and you have a certain amount of hospitality in how you're accommodated. Out on the concourse itself, the concessions all open up and out into the hold rooms, so that when you're having a meal or getting a bite to eat, you're not worried about your flight starting to board without you or a gate change that you don't notice. You're kind of in command of your experience in the terminal. By relaxing like that, it gives you more time in the concessions, gives you more opportunity to spend. I think compared to the other domestic terminals at San Francisco, T2 generated about 14 or 17%, I can't quite remember which, more revenue per passenger than the other domestic terminals at the airport.
How is Terminal 2 at Incheon different from some of the other projects you've worked on?
Well, you know, anything in Asia has a scale that's something in a way unheard of in the States. There's a sort of an advanced understanding of retail and passenger processing that we could actually learn from in some cases. So the Terminal 2 design project really tries to take the lessons learned and the good quality of Terminal 1 and try to take it to a higher level. So it was really, I think, an opportunity to try and find a way to take our experience, build upon what they already have to make what they have better.
In the Terminal 2 design at Incheon, what do you take the most pride in? Is there a certain feature that you've designed that you think that passengers are really going to take to?
I think the one thing that we brought to it was trying to up the level of natural light throughout the facility. I think we took a lot of effort to try and introduce natural light and that sense of calming experience throughout the passenger portions of the terminal.
Incheon International is already more than just an airport. It's been transforming into what is called an aerotropolis. Thompson explains more.
The emerging trend towards airports serving as a hub, a commercial hub, not just a transportation hub, but starting to consolidate commercial, retail, transportation nexus, all within the bounds of the airport, or if not the airport property, within the immediate environs of the airport. You know, people would fly in to go to a meeting at the airport, perhaps never leave the airport, and then fly home. Incheon is a good case in point. They've got that whole business center, two hotels, a third hotel going up, by the way, a Gensler design. But I think that the notion is you bring the commerce to the airport. It serves a need in the community. It reduces traffic congestion on the roads, which has environmental benefits. It brings needed revenue to the airport, which is, you know, goes to support all the other services there.
How do you make an airport look timeless? I mean, I'm sure back in the 1960s, a lot of the airports that were designed then were considered very avant-garde, very modern at the time, but now your LaGuardia's or even Charles de Gaulle's maybe don't look as good as people thought they would. They didn't last the test of time. So when you're designing Terminal 2 here at Incheon, or in your previous designs, how do you keep in mind what would look good 30, 40, 50 years from now?
Boy, if I had an answer to that, I'd really be a superstar. But you know, I think in a way, an airport terminal is an institutional building that needs to serve a very specific public purpose. And sometimes to get too caught up in making it a timeless architectural landmark means that at some point in time it will not serve its intended purpose very well. So there's no good answer. Try to make it flexible. The more flexible you can make it and make it, you know, distinctive and unique, the greater the likelihood that it's going to stand the test of time and become timeless rather than ancient.
Incheon International Airport's Terminal 2 is set for completion by 2018, just in time for the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics. For Monocle in Seoul, I'm Jason Strother.
Thanks, Jason. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Hyphens, exclamations, questions, and ampersands. It's easy to take the punctuation and other symbols that we use to communicate for granted. Like all symbols, these small characters represent something rather more complex than may be gathered on first appearance. Punctuation is also a story of design evolution. Author Keith Houston's new book, Shady Characters, Ampersands, Interrobangs and Other Typographical Curiosities, attempts to shine a light on this overlooked field that often falls down the gap between typography and linguistics. Monocle's David Pleasant met Keith to talk about his research. They started by looking at the seldom seen and even less frequently understood pilcrow.
It looks like a P, where the bowl of the P is filled in, so it's you know, it's black or the colour of the ink, and it has two vertical strokes instead of one, and it's mirrored, so it points to the left rather than the right. It's sometimes called blind P or reverse P. It's incredible, really. The pilcrow is a paragraph mark, and you can trace its history, especially through its name, all the way back to basically the origins of punctuation, even before punctuation as such existed. So the ancient Greeks in the 4th century BC had the concept of a paragraph, and they marked it with a paragraphos, which is just a single horizontal line in the margin next to a column of text. And all it meant was there is a break or a change in topic on this line. So if it's a play, it might mean it's a new speaker. If it's like a script, if it's a poem, it might mean this is a new line. Or if it's a general work, maybe it's a new section or a new argument. And so the paragraphos, this line, this concept of the paragraph, stays with us basically since then. The name for the pilcrow comes from paragraphos. It went through French, Old French, paragraph, pelagraph, and then came into English pilcraft and then pilcrow. Whereas the visual appearance of it comes from the Latin name for, I think chapter is the best way to put it, capitulum. So, yeah, sorry.
Very, very complicated story.
It is, yeah.
What happened to it? You mentioned in your book how it then kind of entered a different chapter in its history where it became a kind of decorative item, something more than punctuation, more of a style, more of a reference.
As I said, I mean, paragraphs were important. They have always been important in writing. And so once the pilcrow had appeared, and actually it comes from a C, by the way, for capitulum with a line through it, hence the shape. So this mark, this C-like or P-like mark, was often written in contrasting ink. So a scribe would copy out a document in black ink and they'd leave spaces. Sometimes they'd put a couple of slashes, which would indicate you should put a pilcrow here later, to the rubricator, who is someone who came along later and filled in pilcrows and large initial capitals and so on in red, say red or blue ink. And eventually the concept of the paragraph was so important that it would start on a new line. So there'd be a little gap for a pilcrow at the start of a new line, and a later rubricator would come along and fill it in. But the problem was that printing arrived. Well, not a problem, but it's a problem for the pilcrow. Printing arrived, and suddenly there were many more books to be rubricated. It was easy to do the basic text, the black text. And there basically weren't enough rubricators to go around. They didn't have enough time to fill in all the pilcrows. So the gap that the pilcrow used to live in became the paragraph indent that we still see today. So that was pretty much the end of the line for the pilcrow in its traditional role. It did sort of disappear after that. Now you would see it maybe in a legal document. So if you're referring to a section and a paragraph, you'll see a section symbol, which is like a double S, and then a pilcrow. But as you say, it's become a sort of cult mark of punctuation. If you're a typographer or if you're someone who knows about it, you may just drop in a pilcrow here or there. I've seen the odd website set with pilcrows instead of chapter breaks. It's like a sort of a secret handshake, I think, or a sort of badge of honour to a degree.
Would I know it as something that appears in a Word document and you don't really want it there and you can't work out why you can't get rid of it?
Yes, absolutely. There's a button in Microsoft Word that has a pilcrow on it. And when you press it, it highlights all of the spaces, all of the hidden characters that control how the document looks. So the spaces between words and new lines, which is what the pilcrow is there to represent. So actually, when you do this, you get a kind of medieval appearance in your document. It's a cross between old Roman dots between words and medieval pilcrows and so on.
You also talk about a very familiar sign, the at sign, and its use. How do you kind of make the leap from these very kind of archaic symbols to the at sign, which in itself has quite a long history?
I think that was it. I mean, to a degree, I was able to pick and choose the characters that I focused on. And I think the at symbol I found interesting because it has this incredibly specific modern meaning, you know, either in an email address or in front of a Twitter handle. And yet it's history, as you say, it's a good many centuries old. And in fact, recently, since I've written the book, I found out it probably just meant this is an abbreviation for a longer word that begins with A. But the first sort of definitive proof of that, or the first indication, was that it was used to abbreviate the word amphora, which is a long-necked vase or jug that the Romans and Greeks used to transport goods around. And it became a commercial thing, you know, a number of items at a given price. And it didn't really go anywhere. It was a very commercial symbol. It didn't necessarily have wider application until email came along. And the guy who invented email, called Ray Tomlinson, he needed a symbol to separate the name of the recipient for an email and the computer on which the account lived. And pretty much the only thing he had left was the at symbol, which is nice because, you know, it has the right sort of meaning, user at computer. There was one operating system, however, when you typed an at symbol, it deleted everything up to that point on that line. So there were problems, but one keystroke and basically it stuck. I like the coincidence. I like the kind of the random's the wrong word, but I like the unexpected nature of that.
As opposed to the at symbol that's kind of done well, some haven't. They really have disappeared. There was a really interesting one. Tell us about the, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, the ironietiken. Is that how you say it?
You know what? I don't know.
It's a Dutch word.
Yeah. It was invented by a guy called Bas Jacobs, who's a typographer. Well, I've been saying ironietiken because I think it means literally irony mark. So this was actually commissioned. Someone decided there was a need for an irony mark. There's a Dutch Booksellers Association or Book Industry Association, and they have a ball every year. And the ball this one year, I think it was 2007, had a theme which was to do with irony and satire in writing. And so to make a splash for the event, they commissioned underwear to create an irony mark. And this was the result. So it looks like an exclamation mark, except with a kind of zigzag stroke. I think it looks great. It's a really nice mark. It fits in well with text. The problem is if you use two of them together, they look a bit like the emblem for the Nazi SS, which I think is meant to be two stylized bolts of lightning. So it didn't really take off, which is a shame. And I think I do wonder if you want a new mark of punctuation so much that you design one, they almost never work. It's sort of a recurring theme. I think of a lot of the marks that I looked at, the more deliberate it is, the less chance it has of doing well, which I think is a shame in this case, because I think it's a very pretty mark.
And then there was an example, a similar kind of imposed, forced new punctuation mark from the 60s that you go into.
This is the interrobang, I think, which comes from interrogation, or, you know, to ask a question, and bang, which is printer slang for an exclamation mark. So the mark looks like a question mark and an exclamation mark that share the same point. This was invented by an advertising executive on Madison Avenue, quite a big shot, I think, in his day, called Martin K. Spector. And he didn't want copywriters to terminate sentences with an exclamation mark and a question mark. He thought it looked ugly. So he invented this mark, or rather he invented the concept for the mark and wrote an article about it. And his art director for his advertising agency drew a few designs. And it seemed to get quite a good response, you know, from the readers of this magazine. So the next issue, he wrote another one basically saying, no, this isn't a joke. Let's actually try and make a go of it. It did fairly well. It wound up five or six years after it was first designed, it appeared in a font, in a hot metal font. You could typeset something with an interrobang in it if you wanted. And a year later, it appeared on typewriter keyboards. So basically, assuming you use this one particular font, it was possible for a writer to write something with an interrobang in it and for it to be printed. And it almost worked. Actually, I found a book from, I think, the 80s, which has an interrobang in the title, and yet it just sort of faded away. It didn't quite make the leap to electronic or digital writing or typesetting.
One very last question. Okay. When you were the kind of editing process, how many rereads and second looks?
I think I was more worried about the visual appearance. So there were lots of notes saying, please make sure this character is here, please make sure this character is here. But I think the designer of the inside of the book, Judith Abbott, and the typographer, Brad Walrod, have done a brilliant job. I'm amazed. I feel like I'm responsible for a very small portion of the finished book when I look at it.
That was author Keith Houston chatting to David Pleasant. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now we're off to Berlin to find out about the creation of a building set to house services for people of different religious beliefs, called the House of Prayer and Learning. It will combine a church, a synagogue and a mosque all under one roof. Its organisers hope to make Germany a centre for peace studies and Berlin a meeting ground of world cultures and international relationships. Melanie Sevchenko spoke to the organisers and the architect behind the project about its aim and how Berlin's turbulent past is never far from the city's surface.
For the past 2 years at St. Mary's Church near Alexanderplatz, an evangelical pastor, a rabbi, and an imam have been coming together to conduct services one Sunday every month. Now, the Association of the Three Religions, called the House of Prayer and Learning, wants a prayer space of their own, as what is billed as the first Jewish, Muslim, Christian prayer space. Imam Kandir Sanchi says Berlin is an ideal city for such collaboration.
Berlin is a multifaceted city. You find many people of all kinds of religions. For centuries, there were Jews, of course, and since 18th century, Muslims as well. It's a very important city. I feel that the city is very engaged to support the various religions and make them feel at home in Berlin.
Sanchi's aim with the project is to encourage a more positive future for Muslims in Germany, and to learn from other religions.
It enriches your life to learn from people with a totally different background.
Last year, the association held an architectural design competition, which was awarded to architects Kuhn Melvetzi. For Wilfried Kuhn, the design was inspired by the interaction of faiths.
I think that the whole discussion of this prayer and learning house is about understanding how to deal with difference actively, and understanding that our society is not built on one faith, on one ideology, on one belief, but our society is based on the interactivity and the freedom of difference, which I think is very different from pluralism. It's rather about the interaction and the tension in between and what happens if things encounter each other and remain what they are. So the main focus for us was, dealing with this competition, that each of the religions have their own space and not fused into one.
Kandir Sanchi agrees. He says he's encountered from some critics the fear of a new religion developing.
We don't want to start a new religion. That's why we have three different prayer rooms for each religion under one roof. But we can live together in peace, nonetheless. We don't have a problem with each other, and that's something that scares some people. But if we can achieve this, then we can take away that fear.
The design includes no church towers or minarets. There are three separate religious spaces joined by one central hall, which Kuhn suggests could function as the democratic heart of a community.
We did not want to load any symbolism onto the building either. So from the outside, it's actually very pure and simple, very archaic almost looking, because we did not try to identify the building with religions, symbolically speaking.
The House of Prayer and Learning is aiming to raise an estimated 3 million euro through an international crowdfunding campaign beginning in early 2014 to erect the building. Pastor Gregor Hoberg, who runs St. Mary's Church, initiated the project. He says it brings a completely new concept to institutions of faith.
Ähnlich gelagerte Projekte, wo die Religionen sich in einen Raum teilen.
There are multi-faith spaces like prayer rooms in airports and hospitals all over the world. The special thing here is that the three religions themselves came up with the idea. We developed the concept and we want to bring it to life. From what we know, this is a new thing, a sacred space that we built together.
The location of the House of Prayer and Learning is planned for Petriplatz, on the medieval ruins of the 13th century St. Peter's Church, property that is owned by St. Mary's Church, just blocks away. During the Second World War, St. Peter's Church was damaged beyond repair and eventually demolished in 1964 by the East German government. The area was then turned into a parking lot. Pastor Gregor Hoberg says they've been given a unique opportunity to reflect the past.
We came up with a multi-faith church because we don't need just another church in Berlin. We reflected on what the city needs from religion.
But scholars have criticized the site of the new prayer space. During the war, St. Peter's Church hosted one of the most radical Nazi pastors in Berlin. While serving as an army chaplain, Walter Hoff led hundreds of Eastern European Jews to their deaths. Critics say the House of Prayer and Learning is not doing enough to reveal the site's significant role in the Holocaust. Susanna Heschel is a professor of Jewish studies at Dartmouth College and a scholar of Christian and Jewish relations in Germany during the 19th and 20th centuries. Heschel suggests that the site's connection to Walter Hoff needs to be clearly identified in the new prayer space, as well as in its promotional literature and educational programming.
First of all, you can't begin to have a house of worship unless the foundation is built on honesty and truth. That's why, for example, one of the best-known criticisms is hypocrisy. What is hypocrisy? It's being dishonest. It's trying to conceal. So if we're going to come together as three different religious traditions, we want to meet in all honesty. But have a dialogue of honesty amongst these three religions when the one religion hosting us isn't being honest about its own past.
Anna Puschel, public relations for St. Mary's, says a future exhibition is planned at the House of Prayer and Learning that will address religious coexistence in Berlin, as well as the site's historical connection to the Third Reich. Architect Wilfried Kuhn also feels the past needs to be addressed.
You know that we have a very particular past with regard to the Jewish community. And all this, a building like this, of course, brings up. It came, of course, into the focus that in this church there was a National Socialist priest. Things like that come up and have to be discussed again, but it's very important for us to discuss it. But not always only in the question of guilt and past, but of what it means today and if we may not repeat what we have done in those years.
Kuhn says he's attracted to the project for its grassroots approach that works against exclusion, even of people who don't practice a religion.
They are rather free and grassroots organizations doing this thing, and they actually ask themselves, how can we address the non-religious people? How can we address the secular world? How can we bring those people into this building that maybe do not go to church, do not pray, do not go to the synagogue, but maybe are interested in the question of faith and of community?
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Melanie Savchenko.
You're with Section D. Coming up next, the revival of traditional building techniques in Austria. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, here on Monocle 24. Now, traditional building techniques are enjoying something of a revival in Austria, where clay and straw houses are proving to be a viable alternative to conventional brick and mortar homes. Organic materials mean healthier living and extremely low maintenance bills, but they also mean higher construction costs, as skilled workers are few and far between. Monocle's Alexei Korolyov has more.
This is a question of ecological footprint.
It's really
good for environment. It's really sustainable.
Building with earth is, I don't want to show them the clay. Look, that's clay and that's like an art or like a sculpture. But I want to just use it as a construction material.
The voices of some of those who have encouraged the comeback of clay architecture in Austria. Once considered a material for the poor, clay is now increasingly being used to construct private homes and public buildings all around the country. One of the first Austrian architects to start experimenting with clay is Martin Rauch.
Mein Vorteil ist eigentlich, dass ich,
Based in Austria's westernmost province of Vorarlberg, Rauch has been for more than 25 years a master of compressed or rammed earth technology, a building method used in the construction of the Great Wall of China. We have lost this ability to see earth as a natural material, Rauch says, speaking in a recent television documentary. We cannot imagine earth being used in its pure form, he says. Other Austrian architects, such as Georg Reinberg, are following in his steps.
We are not using clay in a romantic sense. It's nothing looking to the back.
Reinberg says clay has many environmental benefits and is highly versatile.
I think it's a progressive modern material because it's more or less unlimited. We find it everywhere and it has good possibility to give a good climate inside. It takes bad smells and so on. And it goes to go very good together with other bioclimatic materials like wood, straw and so on.
One of Reinberg's most celebrated projects is a clay office building in the village of Tattendorf near Vienna, which was built without using any conventional materials like concrete or metal.
There is a grass roof on top and very much glass, which opens the house from inside to outside.
Roland Meingast helped design the building, which now houses his architecture bureau. He says the building's clay walls, infilled with straw, provide excellent insulation and make for a comfortable working space inside.
The indoor climate is remarkable, stable. It's a big open space over two stories where the sun can flood in, and even some bananas used to grow there.
If maintained properly, clay buildings can potentially last for centuries. The problem is, they are expensive to construct, Meingast says.
With this type of construction, we are about 5 to 10% higher than conventional building. And this is the reason, in a time where everybody looks on any euro, the decision goes to conventional material.
But Austrian authorities seem to be serious about eco-friendly living. In the past few years, they have spent more than 35 million euros on a research program to create green technology homes.
The goal of the Building of Tomorrow research program is to make a very significant contribution to the Building of Tomorrow through efficient energy consumption, through the application of solar energy, and also through the use of ecological construction materials.
Efforts are also being made to refurbish existing housing stock. Earth architect Andy Breuss has run a number of successful renovation projects.
It started with a project in Lower Austria, and there was a very old building. You must know that in Lower Austria and also in Burgenland, for example, if you go to little villages, nearly 80% of the old buildings, of the center of the villages, they are all built in clay.
Breuss says his work is also aimed at changing people's thinking about clay.
The people didn't appreciate this. People living there didn't appreciate these buildings a lot. And friends of mine, they bought a house, and all the people in the villages, they said, tear it away and break it down. And I said, no, let's see what we can do with this material.
Whatever Breuss does with these earthen dwellings, he often runs into difficulties.
Building with earth has a lot of problems. And one of the problems is that there is no industry behind it. Concrete and timber has a big industry, and clay doesn't have. And the second thing is that you have really troubles to find a company or craftsmen who are able to do buildings with clay. It's very hard. I had some problems to find craftsmen. And the third thing is that there is no prefabrication. There is no industry for prefabrication.
But architecture expert Jasmin Blaszek says these problems won't stop the development of eco-architecture, as people across the globe are becoming increasingly concerned about their health.
I'm a part of the generation that is used to think of what kind of food am I eating? Is it biological? Is it not? And I'm choosing. Nowadays, it's like people are starting to think what kind of clothes they are wearing. Is it good for their skin or not? Is it healthy? And I'm sure that in the next few years, people will think of what kind of surrounding am I actually living? Is it healthy? Is it good to me or is it not? And why? I'm not just saying that the only way you can do sustainable architecture is to use clay. But for me, as an architect, I will focus on low tech to reach the more people as possible. And clay is really a good low tech material.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
You're listening to Monocle 24 and Section D with me, Tom Morris. Cork is famously one of Portugal's major natural resources. But as the world goes screw cap, the nation has collectively been thinking of new ways to use one of its best assets. A new exhibition involving famed product and industrial designers and Pritzker Prize-winning architects aims to demonstrate these innovations. Metamorphosis, a principal show that's part of Lisbon's Experimenta Design Festival, enforces the idea that this simple and sustainable material has a plethora of uses, from construction to footwear. Saima Tarek visits the cloisters of Lisbon's Geronimos Monastery to see the 10 eye-opening cork pieces that form Metamorphosis.
A 15th-century Manueline monastery in the Portuguese capital is witnessing in its interiors a frenzied install, as its cloisters are rammed with workmen, designers, a few visiting journalists, and a lot of cork. The golden tones of the cloisters, with their plateresque-style ornamentation and mullion arches, seem to blend seamlessly with the colour and texture of the intriguing objects being put up. Metamorphosis is created in partnership with Corticeira Amorim, a world leader in the cork industry. Its research looks into innovative, creative, and edgy uses for this profoundly Portuguese material, which is sustainable as it is harvested from bark and not the trees themselves. The show, which includes work by Swiss architects Herzog and de Mauron, the late designer James Irvine, and Portuguese architectural legend Alvaro Siza, aims to explore cork's potential through the eyes of global design masters. Experimenta Design President and Curator Guta Moura-Gedge explains further.
The challenge was to, according to the theme of Experimenta, No Borders, to give them total freedom to explore cork. So it's a completely pure research project. So just take a look at this fantastic material, it's a sustainable material, and do think about situations, ideas, dreams, I don't know, objects, structures, to apply it according to this way of living of the 21st century. They came here to Portugal to visit the factory, Corticeira Amorim, and so we spent some months with some designers. Some of them were very quickly. Amanda Levid was very quick in answering and proposing the structure she proposed. Nevertheless, she started with the bench, and then it developed to this structure, and then she started understanding the relation with the sound and the cork. In the middle of the process, Jacques and Pierre decided to do serpentine gallery in cork as well, because I started working on this, so it was really fantastic. We did a book as well, it's going to be launched next December, and that's it. I just fall in love with the space. This space is unique. I was really looking for a special venue to present it. I was not looking for a museum. And so the tone of the stone, yes, it's so similar to cork, so we find it very peculiar and very interesting to play with the mirrors as well.
British architect Amanda Levitt has developed a beautifully shaped cork kit for Metamorphosis, comprising elements that can be combined to form pieces of furniture, or even in total, a wall with soundproofing properties. Herzog and de Meuron present their Cork maquette of the Elbe Philharmonie Concert Hall, currently under construction in Hamburg, while Jasper Morrison's Cork shoes for camper add a more playful element to the exhibition. Lisbon architecture firm Eidish Mateusz have built an entire minimalist Cork house, its style typical of the two brothers' work, that still seems to oddly fit in this Renaissance setting. This fascinating show is a culmination of long-term collaborative work with Cork firm Amorim.
I've started working with them like 4 or 5 years ago when they approached me to think about new uses to explore Cork. And when we did the first launch of the project, the first project we did with them, which is called Materia, we launched it in Milano in 2010, I think. And I was amazed because in the first contact with the designers, they were not aware of the material at all. So this was something used by architects in the 60s, usually hidden, not shown, with a brilliant exception coming from Marcel Breuer. And I was amazed with the amount of designers that were really not aware of the material. And since then, I think that it is true that it is a complex material, but you really can use it in very different ways.
A set of doorknobs and a handrail designed by Portuguese architect Eduardo Souto de Moura, and a nest of two cylindrical stools ergonomically designed with impact absorption by fellow Pritzker Prize winner Alvaro Cesar, show the overt crossover between architecture and design that highlights the theme of Experimenta this year. But João Luís Cadilho de Graça, who is fusing cork with concrete to use in the vast new cruise ship terminal that will be completed in 2015, has come up with arguably the most surprising piece. According to Graça, the symbiosis between cork and concrete is the genesis of a new, lighter, more insulating and aesthetically pleasing material.
When we began the project, the execution project for the cruise terminal, we understood that they had already put the piles to support the building when they made the first works, and the capacity of load support of that piles are limited. So I wanted to make the facade in a kind of continuous way, not with panels or something like that. And I remember that I could do this because I had already spoken with them. And this is interesting because it's a structural concrete, but also with adding the dust and the granulate of cork. After doing that, I remember that in 1987, I made a work with my students that was something like in science fiction in 2017, near the castle, a house. And I invented a material that does not exist, that are panels with 20 centimeters, that have load capacity and also resistance and also insulation capacity. And this material is not so far from that. I always try to think on the nature of the phenomenons or the structures, the let's say, not in the result but in the mechanism that produces the result. But I always like this, the touch of mixing cork with other things. I think it's very interesting. The molecular of cork is incredible because you can left a piece of cork outside during 100 years and when you go there, it's more or less the same. And if you press during 100 years, when we put the press off, the cork regains the original form. It's incredible. I think it's very useful, very resistant, with an incredible capacity of insulation for the in thermal way, and also absorption of noise. And so I think in the future it's going to be very used.
Though clearly a well-thought-out promotion tactic for Portugal's cork industry by one of its leading companies, Metamorphosis and its offerings prove that this material can benefit the work of current and future generations of architects and designers. For Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Simon Tarek.
What a corker. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on Section D. To play you out and to wish you a fond farewell, this is So This Is Goodbye by the Junior Boys. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.